Hello.
Podcast Network Asia.
When you're chief data and analytics officer, you focus 90% on the people and 10% on the, okay, here's how I actually go about doing it. Executives, leaders are people who feel like at the core, they are people that work in the service of people. And that's not in the service of just your customers. That's in the service of the rank and file and people at the, you know, the entry level parts of your organization. You really have to be that selfless. So that's a huge, huge misconception about what a good leader is.
We are here to answer questions and debunk job descriptions by interviewing professionals so we can put an end to our career search. This is Job Defined. I usually start off with this question, Pat. What was your childhood dream?
So I'm an 80s kid, right? I grew up during the 80s. Pretty awesome childhood there in the United States. It was the cable era, the video game era. And so growing up as a child, I actually wanted to get either into film as a screenplay writer, or more importantly, potentially as a broadcast journalist, which was a hot career that was really coming out. I really loved being creative and publicly speaking, even as a young child.
Okay, so it makes me wonder, how did you end up in your current career right now? It seems like you were more on the creative side and suddenly you delve into the data industry.
Yeah, it's pretty ironic of all things, right? So, you know, the show is only, I think, 30, 45 minutes. I'll spare you all the gory details. But the reason why I got into this career was really because I learned very early on that I had really absolutely no idea really what I wanted to do. And rather than sort of having this predefined notion in my head of a job title or a company or, you know, a salary, I decided to put all those quote unquote things away and actually define what my career should be and what I wanted to do based upon the experiences I wanted to have. And when I did that, I found myself really taking a lot of left turns, right turns, ups and downs. But more importantly, I felt like that was actually the shortest path to getting into both technology and where I'm actually at today. And ironically, believe it or not, even though I wanted to be a broadcast journalist, I'm sitting here in front of you right now doing what? Doing a podcast. Talking about what? Talking about data and analytics. So, again, I couldn't have engineered it that way, but here I am doing exactly what I thought I wanted to do as a child and love. It's just with a spin of being, frankly, a data nerd. And that's okay, too. I like that as well.
Okay. Was there a turning point in your career? Maybe of course, you had a couple of jobs already. And even before you entered the industry, was there a turning point where you told yourself, you know what, this is the profession for me?
Yeah. You know what? The best advice that I've learned and I would give everybody, no matter where you're at in your career, everyone has low points in their career, whether it was a job that you're just, you know, you're burning the midnight oil, you're having a tough spot. Maybe you hit a rut during the pandemic, right? I think there's so many reasons to quit. And the natural instinct in psychology is fight or flight. And the most important turning point for me is understanding when I should fight and when I should flight, because there have been absolutely some circumstances at jobs where I thought, okay, I've gotten everything I need out of this and I need to move on. And then there are some jobs where I'm just literally dying. I'm getting, you know, it's painful and I'm literally bleeding out, unhappy, but I'm like, gosh, but there's still so much potential here. I'm not done. So what is it I have to do? And so the turning point for me in particular came after I was working for a large technology company that was the backbone of the internet, Sun Microsystems. They're no longer around, but they used to make these big servers that basically powered the early days of the internet. And I love that job, love that company, love that culture, but it got sold off. It basically died. And that turning point was, I was really quite lost because I had this sort of dependency on that company and it defined me so much that I thought, well, I'm not ready to leave, to flight. But I have to. And ironically, I found myself in the next job making video games of all things. So working for a company that made computers to now saying I have a lot of transferable skills that can apply to now doing something super cool and creative. So that was my first foray into getting into more a creative space and making and developing video games. Video games like FIFA, Need for Speed, Command and Conquer, titles that I think your audience can probably appreciate. You're talking to one of the guys that was part of it.
Oh, wow. I actually play those games.
Good, good.
I'm actually curious. The Sun Micro Systems, are these the guys who used to make those, what do you call this, like Microsoft Word type systems? Like they used to have, I remember I used to use Sun, like a Word type.
We did. We had the first open source. God, I don't even remember the name. Pat, you're really challenging me. But we had the first open source. When people couldn't afford Word and Microsoft and Office Suite, they would use our only option, which eventually, by the way, became, believe it or not, the Google versions of productivity tools eventually, because they're all based upon Java, which is essentially, at the end of the day, the fundamental code base. So yeah, we did make that. It wasn't very profitable, to be honest with you, but we're more known for the big servers that were as large as rooms that powered the entire backbone of the internet.
Yeah, but I remember those softwares because I would use them before. So yeah, that's why when I saw it, I was like, okay, I think that this was the same thing.
Yeah. If you really want to know something about Sun Microsystems legacy, go turn on YouTube and go watch Facebook campus tours, because that was my campus. That was literally, and now I look at it, I go, oh man, I wish I worked for Facebook, or at least I worked there at the time, because it wasn't nearly as cool as it is now. Yeah.
Okay. So as a chief data and analytics officer, what are the three things you enjoy the most about your job, or particularly the whole profession, the career?
Yeah. Number one, and this is going to probably sound again ironic because it has nothing to do with data or analytics, I really love the people I get to work with, whether they be people at my company, my employees, my peers, whether it be with people like yourself outside or even my customers. I think that one of the greatest things you can do for yourself is when you find something you're passionate about and that you enjoy, that you share. And so when it comes to the people, the first thing I love most is being able to share, hey, I don't have the best singing skills or the best dancing skills. I'm so anti-Filipino in that sense. I can't even play the piano or any musical instrument, but I know data and I know analytics pretty well. And the fact that I get to share that with people on many levels, that is really, frankly, the funnest thing that I could ever dream for. And I'm quite blessed to have. The other two things that I love about my job are the really nerdy sides. Is we live in a digital era where technology is advancing so fast. So whether the second thing is, you know, artificial intelligence and the application of artificial intelligence across multiple domains and use cases, whether it be, again, self-driving cars, smart cities, or just helping people pay their bills or helping people take care of their families. There's so many great ways we can use this technology. And then the last thing is automation. I'm all about increasing human productivity in order to make sure that we can spend more time on things that are more meaningful for us. So for me, it's my family, it's my friends, it's those things that are much closer to me, and utilizing automation so that I can start to sort of reshift my priorities in life and not do things that are so manual at work. No. So those are the three things that I love most about my job.
Okay. So you mentioned about automation. I just want to hear your thoughts on automation and how it replaces traditional jobs, and what are your thoughts on that?
Yeah, so there's this sort of like a Terminator sort of science fiction-y spin to that, right? Oh, automation and AI will replace human existence and productivity. That is only like literally 1.0000% true. It certainly would to some degree, but human evolution will evolve to always need to train this level of technology. We're not nearly at a state where human value, human intelligence itself, cognitive intelligence is in a position that it can easily be replaced by AI or automation. So what I tell individuals that are perhaps in jobs that are shrinking is to certainly you want to always re-innovate yourself. Even in my position in technology, I always have to re-innovate myself. And so as long as you prepare yourself for that, you can actually embrace automation and AI in a way that is helping you as opposed to hurting you. So as an example to that, let's say you're someone who works in manufacturing. You work in literally building things, right? Understanding how those machines work, and more importantly, how you can train those machines is a new next elevation of careers. And so we see a lot of startups right now in this industry that are hiring people who literally train, guess what? Chatbots, or train how to read contracts, or train how to do repeatable jobs that human beings no longer really. Again, it's not a value for us to do those things, but human beings can now move on the other side of the coin and say, well, let me be a part of that design or part of that training of these systems. And now my job has changed. And more importantly, it's probably more lucrative at the end of the day as well.
It's actually good insight. And coming from experience, I've been recruiting a lot of people from the digital side, and I noticed that normally after a year or two, whatever technical skill you know, most likely you will be obsolete.
Mm-hmm.
So one of the best web developers, full stack developers that I actually know are really a big fans of mm-hmm. continuous learning. So they always reinvent themselves.
Absolutely. That is the critical. And ironically, I wasn't always that way, Pat, to be honest with you. When I was getting out of college, I was so eager to just get out into the workforce. I was like, screw school, screw college, screw all the academics. And ironically, it's turned around now. So I spent so much time getting into having experiences. But now I'm at a stage in my career as a CDAO that I actually want to learn more so I can enrich my experiences. And I think if folks who are looking for jobs and looking for careers take that opposite approach, what they're actually going to find is they'll become a natural learner. And more importantly, as challenges come their way, their ability to process, their ability to adapt, their ability to do critical thinking, to adapt to that circumstance is going to be a lot easier than constantly fighting it and butting heads with it. And again, I think that's an important thing when you're trying to define your career and career growth is looking at things that are not superficial and aesthetic, but looking at things that are more meaningful to you and figuring out how do you work with the tools and the cards that you have.
Okay, very well said. Now, my next question is, was there a part of your job that you didn't like, but learned how to love? And like an acquired taste or something you felt indifferent about, but ended up liking?
Of course. There isn't a job in the world that exists, right? Even the actors, actresses, all the ones that have these glamour jobs, everyone doesn't like something about their job, right? And for me, the one thing that I really didn't like was, not so ironically, is all the manual mumbo jumbo. I remember in the early part of my career, I was pretty impatient and we would get into these big engineering rooms and there'd be too many voices, right? Too many cooks in the kitchen, if you will, too many opinions, right? Democracy is messy when you have people voting and no one votes the same way, right? And so that was always one of the things that I really fought against. And then I think I just sort of realized that, hey, look, this is not about me being right or me getting my way. I'm part of an ecosystem in here, in this place, it was called an engineering democracy of all the minds coming together and not defining one person's vision, but many people's vision. And so I actually started to really like that and appreciate. And my patience level, you know, I didn't have to do these woo-saw techniques of calming myself down. It just naturally sort of came down. Said, oh, well, let me listen to Jack a little bit more before I tell him he's full of, you know, beep, beep, beep. Let me really try to understand the nuance. And let me, more importantly, let me see how I can add to that, to what Jack is saying, and see how we can collectively do something. So there's this natural force of always disagreeing to some degree with people in that you work with. But finding a mechanism for me in this thing that I hated, disagreements, was finding a way to productively work through it was so critical to not just my success, but frankly, the team and the company's success going forward. So I think that's the way you have to think about things. You don't always have to rid of things that you don't like. Maybe sometimes you need to just re-engineer how you work within it. And I think you can be creative doing that and successful.
All right. When it comes to, let's go back to your childhood dream of being a broadcasting.
Yeah.
A broadcaster. So is there some sort of connection between your childhood dream and what you're currently doing right now?
Yeah, absolutely. If I was a chief data and analytics officer that was, you know, buried into my computer, not out there talking to the world about the cool things I was building and the cool conversations I was building, I guarantee you I probably wouldn't be in this career longer than another couple years. I'd get burnt out and I'd be pretty miserable and happy. And so again, left brain, right brain for me is being here with just you today, believe it or not. You know, for all the great stuff I did today from an engineering and data and analytics perspective, I was actually looking forward to this 45 minutes the most because I like exactly doing that. It's not only a cathartic release of energy and creative distribution for me as a person, but more importantly, it really kind of makes everything whole, right? So I can invent the greatest thing in the world, but if I don't have anyone to share it with, or I don't have a community to benefit from, then I really feel like something's missing. And so that childhood dream about public speaking, sharing, working with people, as well as using my technical skills, they must go hand in hand together. They are like peas and carrots, if you will, to use an analogy.
Okay. Throughout our discussion, it seems the way my perception of you is you're a very creative guy. I mean, just look at your background and even the way you're presenting yourself. And when you say data, normally maybe in mainstream or in other people's, how people other see it, data seems to be boring and creativity and data doesn't seem to go hand in hand. So where does creativity play when it comes to the profession of data professional?
Oh, that's such a great question. Such an awesome question. So you ever look at a, like maybe a painting or some sort of art and go, wow, I really like that. And I don't know why. Right. So the longer you look at it, the more layers you start to appreciate it. And the more things you really start to get excited about when you look at that piece of art. Well, in a lot of ways, believe it or not, that is also data. Right. So in the next 45 minutes, you and I will be creating about 45 minutes of content or 45 minutes of data. And there's someone going to be reading this or watching this and listening to this and saying, well, that was pretty entertaining or not entertaining. But it may reside in their mind and it may reside longer than a day or 2 days. And they might go back to go, you know what? I didn't care for Patrick, but there's 3 minutes or 5 minutes that I really appreciated what he said on reflection of that. And that is what data and creativity is about, is sometimes when you look at data, whether it be a spreadsheet or whether it be about a recommendation of what people are buying on a website like Shopee or Amazon or something else, or whether it be simply about how the financials of your company is doing, the longer you look at it and the more ability you have to analyze it, the more enriching it becomes. And so it's absolutely a creative and cathartic process to look at data and look at it many different ways and understand and realize, wow, there's another story going on there than other than my own human bias. And that is actually the most interesting part, is as human beings, we are naturally narcissistic. We are naturally arrogant with our biases. Everyone has them. They're not always bad. They're not always good. But it is a way and a frame of mind that is built upon our experiences about how we see the world. And data is a truth. If we're looking and using data responsibly, and that is the key, if we're using data responsibly, it will tell us an underlying truth that we did not appreciate before. That is creativity and the essence of creativity in our ability to identify that. So yeah, data and creativity are actually more synonymous than they are opposites.
My takeaway from what you mentioned is that with creativity, you can actually make sense of data.
Yes. Absolutely. You can hypothesize, right? You can come up with theories. You can test it against the data, and the data will tell you whether or not your hypothesis and your creativity is right or wrong, or more importantly, steer you in the right direction, because it's not always best to be right or wrong. Sometimes it's more, hey, sometimes there's better questions to be asking until we finally get to what's actually right. And that's exactly what creativity and data will do for you.
Okay. So I have this principle that I've been using for throughout the years. And it reminded me of data because of our discussion right now. Because I'm a big believer of the more people we talk to, the smarter we get.
Sure.
And then at the same time, it's pointless to connect the dots if you're coming from the same point.
Correct.
So it has to be coming from multiple areas. What are your thoughts on that?
Absolutely, right. To use a super basic analogy, imagine us back in our primary schools and our math books were, 100 pages, right? And it was one book. Now imagine the ability to have five different books from around the world at the same levels of primary taught in four or five different methodologies, right? The Singaporean version of math, the US version of math. Do you think on of capacity of data? Absolutely, you will, right? So it is the exact same thing. The more we ingest, the more, and again, important, the more we let down our guard about our bias and are willing to learn and examine, the more we will really understand a greater level of truth and a greater level of fact versus fiction through this whole process of analyzing and hypothesizing and going through our experiments. So it's absolutely true that whether it's a machine like AI or whether it's a human being, the more data you give it, the smarter it's actually going to be, as long as, again, you remove some of those toxic things like bias and other things.
Okay. I have a question for you. So most likely with your position as being the chief data, most of the things that you gather and make sense of is used for decision making. I am assuming that's the case. And the question is, which one do you choose, data or gut?
Both. Both. Actually, both. People see that as sort of like people who view the world in a very binary way will say you got to pick one or the other. But at the end of the day, the best thing is to always do both, because what I always tell the CEOs and the CTOs and the customers of mine that are asking me to help them build data and analytics projects is, well, will this drive my company? I go, well, no, you you're still the captain of the ship. You still make the decision. It will inform you. There's a difference between being informed and being driven. It will inform you and it may influence you, but it doesn't necessarily have to drive you to where you're going to go. It's still you in the seat that will determine whether that data was useful or not, or shaped your decisions and so on and so forth. So I always say it's both. It doesn't matter if you're the general manager using analytics of a very expensive professional sports team, like in baseball or in soccer or football or basketball, or if you're, you know, the CFO of a very large conglomerate bank. At the end of the day, use both. Why would you limit yourself with those tools? Human knowledge and human thinking and critical thinking is still a very important, useful tool. Use that as well as data, and you've got the best toolbox in the world.
It seems like data is never wrong from our discussion. Data is never wrong. And the thing that makes it wrong are the people. Is that correct?
Data is always wrong. And people are one of the number one reasons why data is always wrong. But data also can be very wrong because it can also be quite misleading. The pandemic is a perfect example of that, right? We have never experienced this on a scale in humanity at all. So it doesn't matter what business you're in. It doesn't matter, you know, what your personal life is. We're all experiencing something new. And so there is no data really right now historically that could help us train how best to manage this pandemic. And so in a lot of ways, the predictive sort of variables associated to how to manage the pandemic well as a company, as a profit, as a nonprofit, as a person, we're all still sort of flying by the seat of their pants. And again, that's the perfect emphasis why you don't lose that human critical thinking plus data as the best tools in the toolbox to help you guide you through the pandemic. So yeah, data is often wrong.
All right. Thanks for that. And we go now to the next segment, which is basically debunking. And this is one of my favorite questions, which is, what are the top three misconceptions about your job?
You know, I think that if you ask a deal pool of folks that want to be some sort of kind of executive or some kind of entrepreneur that owns their own company, they have this very glamorous idea of what it's like, and everyone does it. I know I certainly do. It's, again, human nature to dream. But the number one misconception about being executive in data and analytics is that it's only about data and analytics and engineering. Actually, the most important thing about my job is really people management, whether it's in my customers, my employees, or my peers. I am a facilitation or a tool in myself to help all of these individuals achieve something that they need to achieve and problem solve problems that they need to solve. And I just simply have this toolbox called the Big Data and Analytics Toolbox that helps them do that. But if I completely tune out to who they are as a person and what problems they're trying to solve and what end goals they're trying to meet, and I just apply tools to it, I guarantee you I won't be doing as good of a job. And here's a really perfect analogy of this. Let's say the job that you have, Pat, is you've asked me to help build you a house. And I go, no problem, Pat. I've built plenty of houses. Let me get my toolbox out and build you a house. At the end of that project, you look at that house, you go, oh, Patrick, this didn't account for my family. This didn't account for how my kids need to live in this house, how my wife wants to use her studio for exercise. This didn't account for my hobby in music. It didn't account for the fact that I need to get away from my family and have a man cave. Why didn't you take all those things into account? And I'd say, well, because I didn't spend enough time talking to you as a person to understand the things that you are trying to solve. And so it's the perfect analogy for, again, when you're a chief data and analytics officer, you focus 90% on the people and 10% on the, okay, here's how I actually go about doing it. And so I think that's perhaps really, you gave me three, but I'm going to say those are two because they're so big misconceptions about the job. The last misconception that I think is super critical for people is that if you're really not an enabler and a problem solver and you don't feel like you can work in the service of people, don't become an executive. Don't. Because you're not going to be a very good executive. Executives, leaders are people who feel like at the core, they are people that work in the service of people. And that's not in the service of just your customers. That's in the service of the rank and file and people at the entry level parts of your organization. You really have to be that selfless and more importantly, that willing to say, okay, how can I help you coming out of college become the best engineer, the best business analyst, data analyst you need to come? Because I've got 22, 25 years worth of experience. And, you know, it may not be the exact way you need to do it, but I've got information, I've got data about how you can do that. So that's a huge, huge misconception about what a good leader is.
Hello, this is Agnes Ravasho, CEO at MDI Novaria Technologies. Come listen to My Digital Impact, where I talk about customer experience obsession with fellow business leaders, about relatable moments on customer excellence, and teachable experiences on customer service. My Digital Impact is available wherever you listen to your podcasts, powered by Podcast Network Asia. Check us out after listening to this one.
Okay, actually, you got me curious. I have this thought in my head that you are the chief data right now for MDI Novare, and you're an executive and you are a data professional. And I remember when I went to Vietnam a couple of years ago, I met with a lot of executives there. I remember I asked all of them similar questions, at least five of them, and I asked them, what is your number one role in this organization? And most of them answered, their biggest role is to ask questions. And I think, in my opinion, data professionals are actually good at asking questions because you need to, you know, gather those data. And that would make you a good executive as well. What are your thoughts on that?
I completely agree. You have to be a natural learner, natural person that's curious about everything, because there's so many ways to solve problems in this world, whether you're solving a problem for your customers or for your people. And if you don't have the ability to converse with people, engage with them and ask them questions that sometimes they don't have the literacy or the understanding to even know, then those are going to be very short conversations. And so having the ability to have a conversation with someone, here's a really great analogy. Hopefully you don't get sick of my analogies, Pat. A good doctor is not just a doctor with the best medical degree. What happens when you go to the doctor? Oh, doc, my stomach hurts. It hurts here. It hurts there. I think I have cancer. And the doctor sort of looks at you, sort of grins, go, well, let's go through the motions. So tell me when it started. Tell me what had happened. What were you eating? Are you exercising? What is your family history? They ask a ton of questions. Why are they doing that? Because they're being a detective. They're being a good doctor. Human biasness is the patient saying, I have cancer. Fix my cancer. Right. And every customer has an idea about what problem they need to solve, but it may not actually be the problem that they need to solve. And so a good data practitioner, a good executive, and a good leader knows how to diagnose and ask questions that a patient sometimes doesn't know how to describe, but may be clues into identifying how they help that particular patient, or in this case, that particular customer. And so that is an analogy I think that's quite appropriate. And frankly, I actually use that analogy when I talk to my customers, saying, hey, look, I know you know what you think you want, but let me ask you 15, 20 questions because I want to explore if there's something else underneath here that may be more important than what you're actually telling me that you actually are trying to do. And that is the sign of a very good executive, as well as a very good data analyst and executive data officer.
All right. Thank you so much for that. Another question here is, what's an undeniable fact about your job, the thing that's always going to be there?
Data is not going away anytime soon. That's for sure. It's actually just growing. We live in this age of misinformation, mass production of data. It's so hard for us as computers. Our brains are computers. It's so hard for us to process. Even for someone like me, that's a professional and at the top of my game, you know, I read emails and go, is that legit? Is that my bank? Is that not my bank? Right? I read Facebook posts and goes, man, that sounds politically right, but I don't know if that's factually right. It is hard. It is actually quite hard. And that is not going away anytime soon. In fact, it's going to become much harder. And there isn't a government, there isn't a system, or there isn't a platform that can actually avoid us from having to experience that, except for right here, except for our own ability to be good critical thinkers and good critical listeners and good critical analyzers. So, undeniable fact about my job and your job, and frankly, everyone's lives, is that we really best think about how to live in a digital and a big data world, because at the end of the day, it doesn't matter if we're trying to figure out just what to get to eat or what we're doing with our bank accounts, our investments accounts, or what we're doing in our professional career. If we don't know how to fundamentally use data, hypothesize data, test data, validate data effectually, you can bet we're going to make some mistakes, and we're going to make sometimes big ones if we don't do that well enough.
All right. So data is here to stay.
Yeah, absolutely.
Okay. So this one is about job descriptions. When you read job descriptions about a data professional or the things that you saw online, when you do a quick Google search, what is the thing that makes you cringe when you read the job description of a data professional?
There's two things. I have to use two things. The one is this overemphasis on title. I want to be a data scientist. What is a data scientist? A data scientist ain't anything to me. As a hiring professional, very good people who are mathematically, algorithmically engineers and minded people. I don't care that you called yourself a chief data scientist at blah, blah, blah. I don't care if it was at Google or Netflix or Facebook. It doesn't mean anything to me, and it doesn't certainly buy you any credibility with me. The second thing I cringe at when I read job descriptions is the overemphasis on programming abilities. If you're somebody who's hiring someone and you're only looking at people and you're overemphasizing someone's ability to write Python or Scala or Spark code over some of the other what I think are more valuable skill sets, then you really have a misunderstanding of technology. The way technology is moving today is in a place where actually coding is going to be pretty soon obsolete. There are a lot of capabilities to do low code, no code. Everything is moving to a drag and drop world. So this ability to communicate at a computer languaging level and be productive, it's a wrong emphasis for people who are hiring and people who are interviewing. So for me, as a hiring professional, when I read those job descriptions or I read people's resumes that are doing that, I really call them out on it and say, hey, look, you know, in the 30 minutes we've been talking, Pat, you can see I put a lot of emphasis on soft skills, problem solving, critical thinking, ability to communicate, ability to be creative. Those things are far more important to me than your ability to write some Python code that my 7-year-old could copy and paste Python code right now. And actually, he probably does right now into script and run a program. That doesn't mean I want to hire him at a high paying job. So overemphasis on programming to me is a waste of time. Now, of course, the caveat, we still need good programmers. So if you are a programmer, you're good. I'm not diluting your value to any company at all. That's not what I'm simply saying. I'm just saying, make sure you have some of those other skills as well, because you'll be a superstar if you do.
All right. Those are two good insights. Now let's go to the last part, which is the defining part. And my first question there is, from your experiences, how would you define the job of a chief data or a data professional? How would you define it?
It's pretty funny. So I just saw this on a similar question, but it's one of those Facebook memes that says, explain your job without telling people what you do. You know? And then all my friends that have very different jobs explain their jobs. And I was like, oh, wow, these guys are super creative. You know, my job in the most simplest and layman's terms, that as I would explain it to my Lola or Lolo, if they were still alive, is number one, I solve problems. And number two, I help create vision and possibilities. That really, at the end of the day, that is sort of my job as a leader, to help solve those problems and create a vision as well for a future that you want. So if you can, again, use those soft skills to help people do that, and then use the technical skills in your toolbox to do that, you're going to be quite successful. So at the most simplest of terms, that's what a CDAO does.
Okay. I have a question for you. And this one is, it seems like with your profession, you can actually go to different companies and it would basically, you would fit in because the profession seems to be very malleable. So For our listeners here, we can use two companies here. Number one is EA. Mm-hmm. And how did you perform there as a data professional? And to your current work right now, or at MDI Novare, so how do you integrate data to EA, and then how did you integrate data into MDI?
Really great question. So you heard me talk about the importance of realizing early in my career how I created a portfolio of transferable skills. And I did that because of I knew that whether I wanted to make video games or self-driving cars or run big, large IT companies like MDI, I knew that if I had a strong portfolio and a foundation of transferable skills, I can go anywhere and do anything. And to your point, Pat, I could leave right now MDI, not that I will, MDI team, but I could go work in banking or insurance or telco or some other large industry here. I can even work in government because I didn't say I wanted to be a CDAO or a career journalist. I said I want to do these things and have these skill sets and experience and strengths. So as it relates to data in the gaming world, right? Believe it or not, all the games you play today are largely defined on how you play them and how they can be improved. So back in 2010, the way I was using data and video gaming at FIFA is we were looking at how people were playing FIFA online. And we realized that when they were playing some of the big players like Ronaldo and Messier and all those guys, they had certain styles and some their styles were quite effective and some weren't as effective, which made the gameplay actually harder to play. And so we're analyzing this data to again inform how we manage some of the sensors on the stick and how we manage some of the gameplay and how we manage some of the competition and how we rated different players in different competition. And so it absolutely is used to design games today. And literally everyone is, you know, they call it the surveillance revolution or the surveillance realm, right? Surveillance being is everyone is looking at the data that you're using and understanding how to serve you better. That's true in retail, as you could probably attest to, Pat, but it's also true in video games. It's true in how people look at your social media. It's true in terms of how everything really works today. Even the NBA is looking at how you watch the NBA and figuring out how can we make the NBA more entertaining. So same is true for data in video games as well as MDI. And in MDI, obviously, the link is quite strongly there, which is we use data to help as a consultant inform our customers of industries. You know, MDI works with the big blue chip companies here in the Philippines, all the big companies you probably all heard of and you probably subscribe to and are a customer of. We look at the trends that are happening outside of the Philippines in the globe and in the region, and we use that information to help inform them to steer a lot of their initiatives. So here in the Philippines, one of my passions is around smart city. And one of the things I want to do is take all of my global experience and knowledge about how technology is being used to help build new urban cities for efficiency, for helping and improving the lives of citizens. And that's what we do at MDI is we really try to make an impact with the data and the technology that we deliver for our customers to help ultimately Filipino citizens.
All right. Very well said. Now, you're big on soft skills throughout our conversation. So for my next question, what are the three top soft skills that, you know, a data professional should have?
You know, I think number one is communication and analysis. To me, they go together. If you can communicate, then you can analyze and assess what folks are actually needing. So that's one, right? The second skill that I think is really important is really understand how to test hypothesis. So you're going to, like I said, get a deluge of information and data in your job, whether you're working on a project for a customer, whether you're trying to get a customer to be your customer, and you have to be able to test ideas quickly, fast. You have to have the ability to know how to fail quickly and safely. And that validation sort of cycle is very important to being a good engineer and a good data professional. And then lastly, I think the third skill that's really important and quite oversimplistic, but it's super important. You have to be a good person. You have to be a person, again, that is selfless and willing to work in the service for other people. And if you find you're comfortable with that, then frankly, you're going to do well to provide a lot of value to your customers and to your fellow peers.
You mentioned about being a good person. Is it because being a data professional, you have these data and it's like you're acting like a counsel to whoever is going to make the decision. So you have to be a good person. Is that in any way connected?
It's very much connected. At the end of the day, sometimes being a data professional means you get beaten up a lot. You don't always get treated the right way because you are a bit of an outlier. You're proposing something that may be not so popular. And if you're a good person and you're with a person with good temperament and is patient and understands, hey, you know, even though I want to prescribe you doing this and solving this to solve your problem, you don't agree, I need to have the resilience, the tenacious ability to get you to see what I see and hopefully at least get you to test it and hypothesize with me to see if it actually is the right fit. And so if you're not a good person, or you're an impatient person, or you're a person who doesn't have that temperament, then probably this is not the kind of role for you, because you're going to find yourself quite frustrated all the time because you don't always get your way. This is not a role where you always get your way. You have to literally fight for it and be and have the tolerance to, and resilience to be able to go do that.
Okay, so it's actually related to my next question. You mentioned about being impatient. So aside from being impatient, I'd like you to fill the sentence up. If you are blank, then this job is not for you.
So I used the patient one already. That's too cheap to use it again. But if you are not analytical, and when I mean analytical, I don't mean, you know, being able to look at a political post on Facebook and analyze and tell your friends or family why they're wrong. That's not analytical to me. What I mean by really analytical is saying, you know what? I have a biasness. I have the ability to put that on the shelf for a second, so I won't listen to myself. Now let me look at this information and let me really analyze it. And then let me get more information and test it. And then let me do more and more testing and more and more testing and more until I've completely exhausted my ability to have an opinion, a valid opinion that's factual on what I need to do. If you don't live your life that way, either because you're not resilient enough, you're not patient enough, you don't have the critical thinking skills to know how to get and obtain data to test yourself, this job is not for you. Absolutely not for you. That you are a square peg in a round hole. Do not go into the data or analytics job.
You guys have been warned. So my next question is, if you are blank, then this job is absolutely for you.
There's so many. I have to pick one. Okay. My favorite, my all-time favorite is, if you are a natural and passionate learner, this job is for you. Quite simply, if you are someone who loves to learn, loves to absorb, you should have a career in data and analytics, because that learning will absolutely lead itself to, again, analytic skills, creative skills, problem-solving skills. I think in terms of doors, it is the first door you have to get through in order to open the other doors of opportunities in a data and analytics career. So be a good learner, and you're doing a good job of getting yourself into having a successful career.
Okay, I actually want to squeeze this question in. If you are a learner, then this job is for you. So throughout our conversation, continuous learning has been popping up, and a lot of information has to be digested by the data professional. And in a sea of available data right now, how do you not get lost in it? And at the same time, of course, not fall into the trap of analysis paralysis. Mm-hmm. So what are your thoughts on that?
Such a great question and such a poignant problem. There is no answer. This is the answer. I struggle with it. Again, as someone who's at the top of their game, I struggle with it. You know, at the end of the day, let's not be robots, right? We're human. And part of being human is acknowledging I have limitations in my capability. Even myself, absolutely, I have limitations, many, many limitations in my capability. And so rather than thinking of it as an infinite ending of analysis to get to a position of fact, more think of it as I will exhaust myself of my limitations, and either I will stumble upon and I will realize what is now factual and solve a problem, or I will get help outside of just me, and I pull in a team, or I'll pull in people. And I mentioned something that I think is absolutely critical to being a good data and analytics person, as well as an engineer. Failing fast and failing often and failing safely is absolutely critical. So it's not important for you to always be right. It's important for you to always be validating and assuring and partnering sometimes with other folks or other resources or other systems or other companies to make sure that what you're actually doing is actually right. So it's not easy. There isn't an easy magic pill to that. There's no cheat sheet. There's no recipe that you can build to master that, Pat. But I guarantee if you do become good at it, through some of the tips I've shared with you, you're absolutely going to be one of the best data and analytics practitioners this world has ever seen.
All right. Thanks for that. And you got me interested when you mentioned fail safely, because in my company or in my practice, I believe there are two types of failures. The first one is controlled failure, where you reach a point where you learned your lesson and you can actually still turn back. You can, you know, from total failure. And the other one is basically total failure where you crash and burn.
Catastrophic, yeah.
So what, can you expound what fail safely means?
Fail safely means that you are not a know-it-all. No one is a know-it-all. But yet, again, you can try something or test something, do A-B testing or some sort of validation, some sort of training, and you are perfectly willing to accept failure as an outcome, because sometimes failure allows you to learn more about what you have to do next than not trying at all. And the perfect example is all those individuals that work in the space field, right? If you're a fan of Elon Musk or SpaceX and what it takes to put human beings on the moon and in Mars, you see them on YouTube like every other day failing with a rocket ship. And right, it's almost ridiculous where you go, that was $3 million. That was $5 million. And you're sitting here wondering, where's this guy getting all this money to fail? And why is he so bad at it? But yet at the end of the day, behind the scenes, these engineers are going, yes, it failed. Now we know exactly what's wrong with it. And that's actually what happens. And so again, failing in a controlled way, as you say, or I say failing safely, is all part of the experimental life. Anyone here learn how to ride a bike and never fall down? Man, I almost broke my ankle, my knee, my shin, my face a million times. But guess what? I'm pretty darn good at riding a bike. It's the same thing with solving problems with data and analytics. You just have to continue practicing, continue doing testing and validation. And eventually, if you're doing it right, you're going to solve that problem for sure.
All right. Thanks for that. And for my last question, I usually wrap up with this question. What advice would you give yourself or to your younger self before you've entered your current profession?
The best advice I could probably give myself, there's a few, of course, because I've made plenty of mistakes, but don't be in such a hurry. Honestly, I was an 80s kid, first generation immigrant in the United States. So I had this cultural pressure that, because I was Asian in America, that I had to do 10 times better than my parents. And I had to put all these things on myself. And so I was never quite satisfied with my achievements. I always thought I could be doing more, doing better. And frankly, my parents pushed me the same way. So not to blame mom and dad. I love you guys. You did great, by the way. But it, you know, I think I grew up with this natural impatience to achieve and to excel. And that blinded me in a lot of ways to look at the bigger picture, ironically. And if I was just more patient with myself and less hard on myself, ironically, I would have probably chosen shorter paths and better paths for myself to get to where I'm at. I always say to my friends that know me most, and this is a bit personal, but I'm happy to share it, is where I'm at right now in my life, I'm so content, but yet I'm also beating myself up because I should have been here 12 years ago by listening to myself and being more patient with myself, as opposed to always going fast and thinking that the next thing is what's going to get me to this paradise that it didn't. It eventually got me there, but eventually it made me work harder than I had to, ironically. So I think that's very true for everyone that might be listening. And no matter where you're at your stage in your career, I guarantee you, love yourself. Don't be so hard on yourself. Don't put too much emphasis on aesthetics, titles, job, money, things like that. Put more emphasis on experiences and growth and learning. And I guarantee you will find yourself in a much happier state, as well as in a more productive state of doing the things that you want to do. And all these other things will sort of just become noise in the background, like my background right now in my screen, just all noise.
Okay. So one last question. So this is out of my curiosity, and I'm pretty sure by this time our listeners are curious as well. What's next for Patrick Meneses?
Oh, cool. Hopefully, if my marketing team who's on this podcast is listening, they are going to help me elevate all the information I have in my head out there into the community. So this is one of hopefully many podcasts and one of the many times you'll see me through the many mediums to talk a little bit about experiences, life, and technology and how these things help shape our human experience. As much as I love to talk about data and analytics, I'd rather talk about, again, improving the Filipino experience here. And I'm hoping with the help of my marketing team and through my own personal podcasts that I can at least share with you some of the things that I've learned throughout my journey. And frankly, also, I can hear from you and learn more about your journeys and become also a better person. So hopefully you guys will look me up, follow me, continue to watch maybe even my podcast as well as Pat's. And hopefully we have some good things to do for each other down the road.
Okay. And basically, that's it. That's a wrap. So thank you so much, Pat. I really enjoyed this. I did not expect like a very, what do you call this? A data professional with strong communication skills.
You thought it would be a tough night. Thank you, Pat. I appreciate you taking the risk and not failing, but succeeding well tonight. I thought I had a lot of fun as well, and I'm glad we were able to chat.
Yeah, I actually learned more about the profession, and I'm actually more, what I like about being a headhunter is that I get to meet a lot of people, interview. It's basically, it became a hobby. I told myself, you know what, just might as well make money out of it. So that's why I started my business. And all walks of life, whether it's a data professional, the previous episode was a chief makeup artist.
Oh, cool.
I was so interested because the makeup artist actually reached the sea level. So those are the things that I'm really curious about. And the more people I talk to, I believe that it makes me smarter as well.
Yeah.
So I enjoyed this. It's
thank you. Yeah, I'm jealous, man. You get to experience something I don't always get to experience. I get more of a homogeneous sort of element of customers that always have the same frame of mind. So I'm jealous of what you do because I'm sure you're taking in a lot more data than I am. And that's an awesome experience to actually have. So it's great.
Yeah. So I want to ask you, how was it for you? I mean, the podcast, how was it?
Oh, I loved it, man. This is fun. And I'm happy to come back if you want to try it about other stuff. So just hit up my team. This is great stuff. I really appreciate you giving me a platform to talk. So it's good.
Yeah. So I believe the listeners would appreciate this because just for your reference, the reason for my podcast is that it started with a childhood dream. When people ask you about your childhood dream, normally would you say a doctor, lawyer, teacher, or
NBA, PBA.
And the thing is, our childhood dream because of our limited exposure to the profession. So those are the only profession that we actually saw. Yeah. And eventually, when you grow up, those people who wanted to be a doctor saw blood and suddenly, up, it's not for me. Yeah. But a lot of my headhunters in my firm actually wanted to be doctors and nurses. And I asked them, why did you want to be a doctor? And they said that they like helping people. And I asked them, what do you like about the headhunting business? They love it when they help people find a job. So it's not really actually what you want to be. It's actually what you want to do, which is to help. Yeah. And I wanted to show to different types of professionals that there are several jobs out there. And several jobs out there. We only live once, but not enough to live out all of those jobs in a lifetime. So I want to make it shorter for them. You know what? If you're a very analytical person and then you're a strong communicator, a curious person, then maybe the data profession is for you. So that's why I wanted to create a catalog of all the jobs out there. So that's basically an advocacy of mine.
Well, good. I'm hoping that I helped you with your vision and your mission in talking really about, you know, transferable skills. Don't focus on job titles because at the end of the day, they don't mean anything. Focus on what the tools you want to use and the experiences you have. And if it's, if you want to help people, you can help many people in many different industries and many different jobs and utilizing your hands and your brain in many ways that you can. You're going to find something that you actually really enjoy that fits you. So hopefully I helped you with that mission.
Yeah, you did. You basically gave justice to the position. So thank you. I'm glad that we had this conversation. Job Define is brought to you by Podcast Network Asia. Check out all the shows in the network by visiting their socials at Podcast Network Asia or visiting their website at podcastnetwork.asia.
The views and opinions expressed by the podcast creators, hosts, and guests do not necessarily reflect the official policy and position of Podcast Network Asia. Any content provided by the people on the podcast are of their own opinion and are not intended to malign any religion, ethnic group, club, organization, company, individual, or anyone or anything.